Hi, everyone. Welcome along to our next Precursive podcast / Precursive Perspective. I'm delighted today to be joined by Brian Lafayette. Have I got the pronunciation correct there?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
There we go.
Spot on.
Thank you. I practiced. From Google. So delighted to have you on, Brian. If we just kick off with, perhaps you can give us a bit of a background about the scope of your role. I think people have heard of Google. So where you work specifically in the business and maybe a little bit about your career history, if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jonathan, thanks for having me. Really appreciative on you, inviting me on here. So I joined Google Cloud through an acquisition, and the company that I work for is called Looker. And if you don't know, if you go back to 2019, Google acquired Looker for about $2.6 billion. I think at the time it might have been their second or third highest acquisition amount ever. So it was really, really exciting time for us. And my journey with Looker started about 5 years ago. So I joined Looker as the very first customer success hire, period. So when I joined, there was probably about 40 or 50 employees. There's probably about 40 or 50 paying customers. And actually at the time, it's kind of funny, our CEO hired me and said, "Brian, we have a challenge." And I said, what's that? And they said, "We've got about 40 or 50 clients that are coming up for renewal and nobody's spoken to them in about a year." So that was my intro to Looker, right? So I was like, okay, what CRM do we have? No Salesforce, no nothing. So we had to stand up everything, going back 4 or 5 years ago. And so in that period of time from, basically 2014 to 2019, built, grew, scale, customer success from the ground up, started working on, morphing our onboarding process, how we work with sales and professional services and customer success, how they all symbiotically work together. And if you fast forward to today, Looker was acquired with about 900 employees, about $170 million in ARR, and about 2,000 clients spread across SMB, mid-market, enterprise. The beauty of Looker is that it's a business intelligence and analytics tool. It can be used for very like cloud native clients that are, small, nimble startups, all the way up to the massive enterprises of the world. You're talking Walmart, Cigna, those types of companies. And as you know, a lot of companies these days are trying to become more data driven. If you look in the news, almost every day you're seeing some sort of chart about, hospitalizations and, cases of COVID-19. Data is the new kind of reality and king. And so Looker plays a strong role in helping companies understand their own data. And so that's something that's internal. We've actually helped a lot of companies medical professionals in the COVID-19 space. So we've actually helped like the state of Oklahoma build their entire dashboarding that they're releasing out to the public. And it's all built on BigQuery, which is Google's cloud native data storage solution, and Looker dashboards. So really, really exciting times.
Okay. Wonderful. Cool. So quite the experience then. So I love those stories because I bet that story didn't come up in the due diligence when they got bought by Google all those years later. That's so funny, isn't it? The romance.
Some of those things got swept under the rug there. But it was great though to see that kind of progression, right? To be able to come in and work with, so just in terms of my personal background, started out as a CSM managing our most strategic accounts, moved into management, built and grew a global CS organization. And that totals about 30 CSMs that are named to accounts, and then about 10 scaled people that are working in a multi-touch kind of tech touch fashion to manage hundreds of accounts at scale. And so in total, it's the 30 named, 10 scaled, 40 people total. And then we work as a part of a team, right? So we've got professional services that helps with onboarding, sales that helps with kind of the expansion licensing, things like that. So, it's not just a one and done, one department. We're part of a broader group that works with these customer accounts. And so it's been a really wonderful journey. And then most recently, I moved over into a programs role. So as my time was coming up after I built and led the team, I had at one point, there were like 12 CSMs that were reporting to me directly. I knew it was time to kind of hire the managers that were going to take their next step in their career. And I moved over into programs that, I was asking myself, how do I help this department and Looker scale within Google? And we were noticing like a big gap when we started to understand, we're going to see a flood of customers coming in from Google, given the breadth and depth of their organization. Right. And we're noticing some breaking points. And so how do we quickly manage risk at scale? How do we quickly onboard customers at scale? And so most recently, I've been working in programs to help scale our customer success efforts as we go from, you know, 2,400 customers to 5,000, 10,000 customers in the next couple of years.
Okay, so programs is like a SWAT team that's helping the business do process improvement, getting better, scaling, that type of thing. Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I like to use the line, I get to be the CSM for CSMs. So like my constituents is the CS department. And so everything that I'm working on helps them, helps scale their efforts, things like that. So that's what I've been working on these days.
All right, cool. Very cool, very cool. Now I saw on your profile, you did soccer at university, is that correct?
I did, yeah, I did.
So I'm gonna use the English term here, where, you know, the US and the UK separated by a common language. So what's your favorite football team / soccer?
So I'm one of these weird fans that I enjoy playing more than I do watching. You know, I watch professionals play and I'm like, I just want to be out there. But if there's one team that I had to fully support, it would be Chelsea. I don't know if it would be, you know, I don't know if it's going to be argued amongst your fans. But the reason that I became a Chelsea fan, I was a goalkeeper. And so all the way going up through through high school and the university, I was playing goalkeeping. And that was my specialty. And there was one goalkeeper that I thought just blew every other goalkeeper out of the water. And that was Peter Cech in his time at Chelsea. His 2004 to 2015 run, that guy, watching him goalkeep for Chelsea was just always just such a pleasure to watch. Yeah. And so because of that, became kind of like a pseudo Chelsea fan. And so I've been a Chelsea fan ever since.
That's good. That's good. Good link. Right. Cool. All right, then. Let's get into a couple of items. So we're all living and working in this new remote reality. Nothing new there. And how is it currently shaping the working environment for you guys and the way that you think about customer success?
That's a great way to start out. The whole working dynamic in the business world, particularly in SaaS, has changed. It might change forever. We won't know until we look back in 2-3 years time. Yeah. But I think that there's a unique opportunity, a narrow window right now to really change the paradigm and really ask ourselves, you know, can we be value adding to our customers and to the companies in which we work with, and really add value in every interaction that doesn't necessarily need to be in person. And, you know, I know confidently previously when we were in pre-COVID at times, you know, the only time that you might have a touch point with a client would be an in-person meeting with a QBR of some sort, right? You travel out there, you book the plane ticket, you go out, you meet these people in person. Yep. And, you know, I think two things really change. One, I think we're realizing that you can add value and build relationships and trust remotely. And you can do things like we're doing right now. You can have conversations. It's more accessible than ever before. And you really can start to build relationships and build trust through remote means. And what do I mean by that, right? There's a simple exercise that we've started doing with clients, and that is, you know, hey, if you're going to be on a Zoom meeting, to kick things off, why don't you have a couple of icebreakers? Why don't you change your Zoom background and put the Zoom background to be a photo of the most recent vacation that you took? And you use a couple of minutes of the meeting to really connect with that person. And I think that because of the new dynamic in which we're working, having that personal connection is one, critical, but two, people are thirsting for that, right? People are locked in their homes. They're not able to go out to bars and restaurants and see their friends or travel or do anything like that. So, you know, they're really wanting that connection right now. And so I think that one, you can do it virtually, but you have to be thoughtful about it. And you have to make sure that, you know, you are, you know, really connecting on a human to human level. Yeah. Even the question you just asked about, you know, football, you know, little things like that, that you can kind of like dig into and understand the person that you're talking with, it can have a profound impact. But I will caveat that by saying, because the new remote reality requires people to be on Zoom meetings, they have to be in calls basically all day. Mm. It puts the pressure on customer success to really be value added. And, you know, you have to ensure that if you are going to have that meeting, if you are going to have that Zoom call, that presentation or what have you, it puts the pressure on customer success to really drive value in every interaction. And so I would say that, like, you know, it is possible to build trust and build relationships, but you have to ensure that you're value adding in every touch point that you're having with your customers.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's very true. I mean, if you put yourself in the customer's shoes, if you are taking meeting after meeting after meeting, there's going to be nothing worse than having to sit on another video call or another Zoom.
Exactly.
Someone that's, you know, either boring you to tears or asking the wrong questions or doing the wrong things. Now, 100% see where you're coming from there. So what do you think is easier about this environment now? And then what is harder about it?
Yeah, what's easier? I think accessibility, right? People are not commuting as much, if they're commuting at all, right? So the accessibility of jumping on a quick Zoom call, getting on a phone call, something like that, it makes it much easier to collaborate with people. But again, if you are value adding for that touch point. And so I think that most people are more accessible than ever before, which is great. You have that ability to connect with others. But that also comes with some drawbacks, right? Some personal drawbacks. You know, you might not be commuting anymore, so you might get, you know, 2 hours or 3 hours back in your day. But then you're trying to balance that with, you know, dogs. Like, I've got my dog that's, you know, laying right next to me here. You've got kids. You've got parents you're taking care of at home. You know, people are getting sick. And so that does become a little bit of a challenge. But that said, I think that the time that people are earning back in their lives that they can reinvest in, you know, developing themselves or working in their business, it makes it more accessible than ever before, which I really appreciate. You no longer have to wait till you buy the ticket, you know, 3 months out to get on a plane to go visit this person. That can be done over Zoom these days.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely think there was a period that we discovered in our business where it was like people just working kind of back to back to back and just fatigue. And so we've really taken a conscious effort to like encourage people to, particularly I do, like when I have one-on-ones or interactions with my team, I'm encouraging them. So I'm like, I'm not bothered if you're not on a screen. Like if you dial in and go for a walk around the block, like you're asking me stuff. I'm not generally asking you to present anything to me in those particular sessions. So just go for a walk and have a chat in the park. And
yeah.
I think just giving people that breathing room is like super, super important.
Yeah. And the second thing that I'd mention is just the default shift to connection. Like I said, a lot of people, because they are at home, they might feel like they don't have the opportunity to engage with people in person at the events that they typically would go to. And therefore, a lot of people are just thirsting for that connection with others. And so again, if you can do it in a kind of authentic, non-self-serving, genuine way, I think that having that accessibility and providing value in every interaction, like people want that connection right now. And so, you know, I think that is kind of a positive.
Okay, cool. Well, look, we talked a little bit about the human element there. So, and I know you're a big data guy and we talked about it before we started recording. So what's the role, why is the role of data continuing to rise in importance in the world of customer success, do you think?
I would say two reasons. It's basically transparency and agility. You know, because you do not have those kind of water cooler type in-office conversations where anecdotally you might run into the engagement manager or the salesperson that worked on the customer account that you're working on, data plays a key part. And data could be quantitative or it could be qualitative. It could be stuff that you got from an interview from a client on a phone call. It could also be you know, usage data that you are getting about a client. But regardless, I think that having that level of transparency is critical to ensuring that all parties are on the same page when everybody's distributed. And I think that, you know, data can play that key kind of connecting link or be that connecting fabric. As people are working in different time zones, they're working from home in different locations, things like that.
Okay, cool. All right, so want to move on to an area which is close to my heart and which you put something in on LinkedIn, which caught my eye, which is why I reached out to you, around, you said that 90 days is too long for an onboarding target time, which I loved because I agree. Why is that?
Think about where the world was 90 days ago.
Yeah.
I mean, and then 90 days prior to that.
Yeah.
90 days, I think that people default to that time length because it's simple, it's easy, it's a quarter of its length, right? You know, you've got 3 months to really fill that gap. And from my perspective, you know, I try to put it in the shoes of myself. If I were working with a vendor and I was just trying to say, you know, let's start this implementation. And if I'm not going to see value until, you know, what are we in July? If I'm not going to see value until October,
yeah,
a lot of things might change. Macroeconomic factors, the business goals might shift.
Yep.
And so, you know, from my perspective, and this is what we try to do at Looker through our onboarding experience, is shorten the time frame considerably, 30 to 60 days kind of tops. But then along the way, what are the quick wins that we can deliver to clients in the trial, in the proof of concept, in the implementation? What are the quick ways that we can get win that build on one another over time? So waiting until you have that kind of big bang launch 90 days later, that seems like kind of an antiquated motion given the velocity at which life is moving these days. And you might have, you know, some sort of macro factor hitting you, tax or whatever is impacting your business. 90 days is just too long these days. And I think that we as CS professionals really need to take a hard look at ourselves and challenge ourselves to get to those quick wins as quickly as possible, knowing that it may not be the big bang launch, but maybe a more iterative approach to launching customers.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's kind of my perspective, and I'm sticking to it.
And okay, so just a side question on that. So if I was in enterprise software, right, and in your professional services team, I might well challenge that to say, well, no one gets anything done in 90 days, right? You know, because we've worked with organizations where they're enterprise customers, Fortune 500 companies, and for example, there are specific release cycles for our app to go into Salesforce, right? And there's capacity issues for the customer. So I totally see what you're saying. So do you feel like, what do you think about that kind of as a pushback on like in that type of space? Do you think that there's a happy medium there somehow?
I absolutely think there is. I mean, effectively, if you're a customer success department that is in charge of any sort of revenue metric, dollar-based net retention, gross retention, you are trying to get to a quick defensive posture as quickly as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, say you're on a 12-month contract, you know, enterprise contract, typically 12 to 36 months in length. If you've got a 3-year agreement and it's going to be a massive, you know, enterprise-wide deployment for a company like Walmart, certainly. Like, we have to understand that there are limitations in how quickly we can move. But I think that it's up to the CS person to really describe their role in accelerating that time to value and reiterating that at every touch point that you have with the client. And I don't think it's the worst thing in the world to challenge some of the norms that says, oh, well, you know, we can't launch this too quickly because that's how it's always been done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there certainly might be some technical limitations, like you said, Salesforce deployment cycles or what have you. But reiterating that, you know, look, my role in customer success is to get you as quickly to value as humanly possible. And I understand we've got this technical hurdle for, you know, the Salesforce deployment. However, I think that we could do these 1, 2, or 3 things that might take us in the span of, you know, 20 to 30 days. And that might start to prove value to your constituents about how we can move more quickly.
Yeah.
And so I think that there is a happy medium. And certainly in the large scale enterprise deployments, you know, it's actually funny. You just saw my wife walk outside.
Yeah,
but she works for Slack and she... And her name's Lindsay, so she'll be on the podcast.
Hey, Lindsay.
But she works in customer success as well, right? So we're a house of customer success here. But she works with the large scale customers of hers at Slack. And so when she talks about large scale deployments, she's talking about a Slack rollout to all of T-Mobile, which is one of the largest telecommunications providers in the US.
Yeah.
And when they're doing rollouts, you're talking about 50 to 60,000 people. That's the number of active users that they're targeting. Certainly, you're not going to get to that level of adoption in the span of 90 days. But I think that you can accelerate and start to show the early progressions. And that's what they do. They take a very quick and iterative approach to rolling out department by department to build on the momentum, the success, so that when you get to 90 days, you already have some demonstrated value and impact around adoption that the platform is providing. And I think that is kind of a great way to approach things. Take a more iterative approach to onboarding is more gradual than, say, this kind of big bang style launch.
All right, cool. So iterative, I love that. That's going to be one of the insights coming out of this. So what are the things that do you think customers underestimate in creating that great onboarding experience?
I think it's the importance and really the value of connection. And what I mean by that is obviously personal connection. Like I said, building trust, building relationships very early on in the relationship, but then also demonstrating that you in customer success really have a thorough grasp as to what that company is trying to achieve with your software. And I've said this before, you know, companies don't like having longer deployment cycles. What they hate is repeating themselves. They hate like if and so I think that when you think about like great customer onboarding, it is all about that continuity of we had a trial or a proof of concept and carrying that information forward so the customer doesn't have to repeat themselves. They want to make sure that, you know, you've been prepped, you know their business challenges, you know that with your platform or your service. And I think that you can do that in a thoughtful way in transitioning from, you know, one department to another. And that comes back to, you know, that concept of data and kind of transparency there. Yeah. But I think that, you know, in tandem with that, obviously carrying through all of the data that's important about a customer's rollout, but then also building relationships along the way. And it goes back to that notion of connections. And so I think that the best onboarding experiences that we've had comes to people that have really thoroughly taken the time to understand me, what my goals are, what my business's goals are, and I don't have to repeat myself. And so if a CS department can nail that, you're well on your way to building a customer for life.
Yeah, great. We'll come back to this theme of, we call it seamless transitions. Like we internally, we have a picture of a vinyl. Like I used to be a DJ. So we
yeah.
got a picture of a vinyl, which says seamless transitions is the name of the track. And that's yep. kind of how we think about the world of sales into implementation or into CS and just one, you know, that flywheel as it were.
Now, Jonathan, I have a question for you then. What kind of music were you spinning?
I was a house DJ. So this is 2000 and like in nightclubs. So I used to DJ a number of nightclubs around the country, in the UK, in London, and it was house music, deep house, tech house. Still love it.
That's love what it.
I listen to when I go on my runs. I'm bringing it back. So I'm getting some decks set up in the garage, clearing out the garage and getting some decks up. I'm gonna
there you go. Well, another thing that you and I share, I love deep house music, love it, the Injuna Deep label, love Lane 8.
Yes.
Love all of, like you're speaking my language. So, you know, if you have some mixtapes, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, your curated Spotify playlist is what you're going to get, Brian. Curated
there we go.
Spotify playlist. So on the, so one of the things that I think is kind of, is misunderstood a little bit. I mean, when we talk to a lot of companies, I mean, you know, we provide software that helps companies with customer onboarding, with managing professional services projects, with capacity planning. And a lot of the time people ask us about, okay, we want to create automation, right? We want to create automation. And I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding around automation, what it can really drive. So to what degree can automation truly play a role in onboarding, particularly in your experience in the enterprise space?
Yeah, this is a super interesting question because it's one that we have it's a constant challenge for us at Looker. So to give you some context, we sell, you know, ARR deals that are down in the low tens of thousands, yeah, all the way up to multi-million dollar contracts. Okay. And I think that there was this preconceived notion when we spun up our customer marketing team, and we had a kind of our named and our scaled mode of kind of customer success delivery,
yeah,
that it was either you were in scaled and you got only scaled things, or you were in enterprise and all you got was your CSM. Right. And what we found is that isn't really actually beneficial. There are some things that we are putting out to customers that go to scaled that are highly applicable to our enterprise clients. And I'll give you an example. We actually have an annual user conference. It's called Join. And this year we decided to make it fully remote. And that's going to be happening later this year in Q4. But we were initially starting to understand like, okay, we've got to send out the email marketing. We've got to send it out for registrations and links and things like that. And historically CSMs were like, no, I just want to send an email to my, you know, clients. But the reach on that isn't very far within a large enterprise like Walmart, right? You might have the CSM working with 10 to 15 different people, whereas Walmart might have multiple thousands of active users. So in that case, we actually are leveraging some of the automated touch points that we're leveraging for all of our scaled clients, and it's going to enterprise. But then we caveat that by saying, if you do want to send a more personalized message to your key champions and sponsors, here's some email copy that you can leverage, you can customize, you can make it very personal so that you can send it as a very one-to-one note as a CSM to these enterprise clients while still leveraging some of the automated capacities of our customer marketing team. And I think that that is like very valuable as a kind of hybrid approach. There are two other things that are very valuable to us, and that is we leverage an app called Pendo for kind of in-app notifications. We leverage Marketo for email distribution, and leveraging those two tools within enterprise for kind of an account-based marketing style approach, it allows us to really get a broader scale and reach within these larger accounts where we might be interacting with 10 to 15 key contacts within a large enterprise. You might be able to reach, you know, multiple thousands of users with a Pendo pop-up that says, hey, we're going to do a webinar on the new features that are being released in Looker. And where previously we had this notion of, oh, well, that should just go to the CSM and the CSM will send it out to their key contacts. Now we're seeing hundreds of people sign up within these larger enterprises that want to know about the new features. Yep. And so I think you can take a more hybrid approach by leveraging the tools and automation. But I would caveat that by saying you really need to have that kind of content and that collateral, that if a CSM wants to have that more one-to-one kind of communication channel, they have the ability to kind of leverage the resources that customer marketing is putting out.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree on that. It's automation of awareness is what I call it. It's like it's the amount of value that you can drive in creating awareness about, you know, your product, your service, just simply mm-hmm. by creating awareness, because so many people out there have had the conversation where a customer says, oh, I didn't know you did that. I didn't know you guys
yep.
did that.
Yep.
And that's yep. like, how can they not? Sometimes people are like, how can they not know? Like, that is literally yep. what it says yep. on our website. It is what we think we talk about all the time. And yeah, people hear that all the time. We, funnily enough, so you know, you're aware, we work with one of your other teams in Google Cloud, and one of the ladies there, she said it brilliantly. She said, one of the directors said, it'd be great if Precursive did this, this, and this. And she's like, it does do those things. It does exactly those yep. things. And we were like, yep. and that's a great example of, like, we need to do a better job at creating awareness, which we're working yeah. on, like, in that, at that, you know, at the different stakeholder groups across the account. So I think automation yeah. is value, because you can't automate that necessarily, that human interaction piece, like, but creating scale is a different story. So
well, and one other example, Jonathan, I mean, we started doing something a little bit unique recently, and that is doing kind of demos that are just done that you can just sign up for on the web. Yep. And this was in partnership between customer success and sales. Yep. And, you know, as I've been working on a lot of our risk management framework, what we found is that, you know, a key element of risk to our customer base, and I'm sure this is constant across the industry, is a relationship risk. You have new champions, your champion gets promoted, people leave the company, people are furloughed, they're laid off. And you have to ensure that you're constantly building this pipeline of people that actually know and are aware of what your product and service does. And so previously we had this kind of one-to-one motion, and we still continue this in the enterprise, but we'll do kind of proactive demos just to make sure that people are aware of what Looker can do for them. Yeah. And what we started to do on the scaled initiative is pointing people to that webinar, that kind of demo that we're doing, kind of a, hey, you sign up on a marketing webpage, you can go and attend this demo, and people in the company at scale are able to get a quick understanding in, you know, 15 to 20 minutes of what Looker does. Yeah. And I think that that's a very good approach to having that hybrid level of automation, right? You might do the one-to-one demo for a key champion within a large enterprise, but then for all the other people that may be a new division, a new department, they have no idea what Looker is, you can point them to this kind of, you know, recurring demo that we're doing on a weekly basis. And that at least gets that awareness out. And I think it's super important to continue that.
Yeah. We're literally just going to be starting that. I mean, we're a much smaller business than you guys. Hopefully not in the future, but we're literally going to be starting that this month. So all customers, yeah. listeners, you're going to be having some, I'm determined to do the first one. We'll see if the team lets me. I'm like, they should hear from me, but I'm not allowed near demos, but we'll see. Cool. So last part is, again, I know something that you're very passionate about, I am as well, and it links back to my DJing reference here, which is around this seamless transition. So my pet peeve is when someone comes into a meeting and says, so Jonathan, what are your challenges? What do you want to solve? And I'm thinking to myself, what did I just spend the last 3 months talking to your colleague about? And do you, like, have you not read the proposal that you sent to us, which was actually really good, which has a great business case in it? So anyway, that's the theme here for those listening. So let's just talk about like the first piece in that, which is quite kind of controversial, this handover element, right?
And yes.
The either the hospital pass or the ball's getting dropped. So what can go wrong in this sales to delivery or sales to CS handover, and what can we do about it?
The first thing that can go wrong is that the transition doesn't happen,
right?
Which I'm sure,
yeah.
Like that's the very first thing.
Yeah.
We're not a clean conscience here. Like, we are guilty of this. There have been customers, admittedly, that have not had the best transition experience. And it's something that I think every company needs to improve upon. But you're blending data, people, and process into this one tiny time frame, which is going from, you know, trial or proof of concept to deal closure to implementation. And because you're coordinating so many different elements on the process side, you need to make sure that there's some sort of meeting stood up, that there's a knowledge transfer. You need to have the data in place, and you have to agree to the metrics that the teams are going to be looking at, so that there's a consistent view. Like, when we close the deal, sales is going to be looking at adoption rates, our key features that the product, that the customer is using, things like that. And that's consistent in professional services and customer success. It needs to be consistent. And on the people side, you're just dealing with people, right? Some people are more open. You know, some sales reps want to be highly involved in the transfer and the handover. Other AEs might want to be more hands-off or laissez-faire. But, you know, it's something that, you know, a lot can go wrong because you're coordinating so many different elements in such a narrow time frame. And again, going back to that kind of, you know, the 90-day limit of trying to get to value more, if those things are not coordinated very succinctly, you know, you might have a transition that takes place 3 weeks after the deal closes. You might have an implementation kickoff that takes two weeks after that. And at that point, you've already burned half of your 90-day window and you haven't even started the engagement. Yeah. And so, you know, in terms of what can go wrong, I mean, you cannot have any sort of transfer. You could not be aligning on the metrics. You cannot have the process stood up by which you have these teams coming together to meet about the customer. Because you're coordinating so many different kind of work threads, a lot can go wrong there. And I think ultimately it's the customer that kind of is the person that kind of takes the brunt of that, because now they're just sitting there saying, you know, I haven't had anybody contact me. I don't even know if they know what my business use case is.
Yeah.
And it's a challenge. And so, you know, I can kind of go through what we've done to kind of address that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a lot to coordinate, man. It's a lot. It's not easy.
All right. Well, let's expand on that a little bit, because I think it's really interesting. So what might be one or two tips of things that you guys have done that you would think would be of use to our audience? And I'm going to steal your ideas as well.
Yeah, absolutely. This is an iterative process. Like I said, this is hard. We don't have it figured out. If you look across the industry, I've interviewed, probably close to 300 to 500 CSM candidates to hire over the years.
Right.
And when I ask them about their CS experience and what their CS department is about, what's their ethos, everybody does this slightly differently. And so I think it's up to everybody, your listeners, et cetera, to really listen to all these ways that different companies are approaching this and figure out what works for your business. For us, what we decided to do is more on the process and the data front. So on the data front, we defined what are the key metrics that we look at going from trial to implementation to ongoing customer success that are consistent in terms of success metrics. And these are key features of the product on the quantitative side. Adoption rates, like the contact rate, are they opening up our emails? Are they engaging with us? Anything that can measure both the relationship strength and their ability to start getting some hands-on usage of the product. And that's on the quantitative side. On the qualitative side, we also agreed that we were going to capture these details in the trial process, and we named a custom object in Salesforce called Value One. And what's Value One? Value One is the business use case that this customer is trying to solve with Looker. And it is something that is a mandatory requirement that a sales engineer fills out prior to the deal closing. And it forces the sales engineer to really think critically about, you know, hey, we might have just spun up this trial, it was very quick to close, but realistically, what are they really trying to achieve with our platform or our service? And it, you know, having that kind of qualitative object, you know, be filled out, it's mandatory. That then gets passed over to professional services, and now we're guiding the implementation based on the value object. And it's something that, you know, having that nomenclature, having that consistent language across teams It's something that we instituted. We've been a broken record about repeating this to every onboarding, every new employee that comes on board. What is the value one of this client? We have to have the value one. Like, if the value one's not filled out, we can't close the deal. And it's been great, because then if you have that data and you have the both the quantitative, how they're using the product, what's the relationship engagement, things like that, you couple that with the value one, that gives us some consistency across teams, where now if I'm in professional services or I'm in customer success, we replay that to the customer. Hey, I understood your use case to be X, Y, and Z, and you're trying to achieve 1, 2, and 3 things with our product. Is that right? Did we miss anything?
Yeah,
and you're showing that you've done your research.
Yeah.
So that's on the data front. On the process front, obviously we have a defined process of when a customer gets to a certain stage in the trial process, there has to be some sort of predetermined kickoff meeting that happens between the sales team, professional services, and customer success.
Yeah.
And that's the way that we're able to ensure that this data gets reviewed internally before we prep for an external meeting with a customer.
Yeah, yeah. I love that, because I'm a big believer in, like, the way that you set out your stall, well, the way that you create credibility is like, this is what I know, as in, this is what I know about the things you want to achieve. Is that correct? Or how would you add?
Yes.
I might not use exactly the right language, but have we understood it very correctly? There's nothing better than saying, like, here's what I know. And someone goes, yeah, bang on. That's exactly correct. Like, it's like you then have the right to, or not the right, but you then are in a position where you can be on the offensive, right? And be, because you said something earlier around, like, you want to get to as quickly to a point of where you can defend, obviously, the ARR, right? Or, you know, defend. Yeah. I get that. I think the way that, one of the things that I try to coach people on is, like, it's all about being on offense, right? So customer success naturally generates, because there's this thing about renewal and retention, and I talked to Zip about this, who I know you know as well. It's like, it naturally pushes you towards this defensive mindset, right?
Yes.
And it's much more about, well, actually flip it and be like, if it's you're on an offensive position, as in, imagine a world where you've set up the customer, it's all smooth, they love you, and they're like, hey, what's the next thing I can buy from you? Like, that's the mindset that you want to go in with. But to your point, I think where companies really struggle is that transition between the sales and CS and the handover. You use the word transition, which I love, which I know Jay Nathan's a big fan of as well. I think there's a few things that I'm encouraging people on is, like, if you sell something where you have a business case slide, that is slide one in your CS kickoff deck.
Yes.
Well, yeah, slide one in your implementation deck. Before the implementation plan, it's like, that is the connecting tissue between those two teams. And then you have to have that playback sentence. And it's just these little frameworks that people can learn so they have better conversations.
Yep.
And I think sometimes there's this so much focus around, you know, process and people. And it's like, how do you set someone up to have a very positive, offensive conversation from day one? Do you get what I mean?
Absolutely. And I mean, making that shift to being in the offensive in customer success is, I think it's a place where a lot of companies and CS departments in general struggle. They think, how do I get this customer to the bare minimum for renewal? And what I like about what you said is, and this is what we try to do, we're not trying to get them. We want to get them to a defensible position where we're able to build value for this client and they're buying more at renewal. So if that is, you know, what we're striving for, we're asking some of the hard questions, you know, in the kickoff meeting. Hey, who's not involved that should be, right? I know we've been working with you on the trial and the kickoff, and that's been amazing, but who else should we be talking to? Who is not in this meeting that should be?
Yeah.
And, you know, what are the business use cases of Looker that we have not, you know, deployed to? What's next, you know, for us to roll? Look, what's the next department, right? And we have this other concept, like value N plus one, right? What's the value? What's the next value? What's, you know, if we're rolling out for an analytics use case in the marketing department, well, marketing works closely with sales. Is there somebody within sales that you think would find value from Looker? Should we bring them into this meeting? And we're starting to see, you know, tee up this kind of iterative and gradual approach to get them to a quick win as soon as possible for that business use case and value, and then build for future departments to be rolled out to. And so we're always trying to build on this, you know, from one department to the next, go wall to wall in terms of a deployment of Looker. You said something that really resonated with me, and that is, you know, replaying the value, which I think is super important. You come to that meeting, that kickoff meeting, and you're replaying the stuff that you heard from the trial, what they learned, what they did, And you bring that back up in every touch point. Hey guys, just to make sure that we're all aware, right? Here's the business use case. This is what we're striving for. We want to get attribution analysis done for the marketing department, and we want it done in the next 3 weeks. Yeah. Has anything changed? Like, what dynamics have gone on in your business that might have shifted that goal? And you know, every time you meet with a customer in that very critical phase in onboarding, that replaying of value and making sure that you're replaying what you heard from the client, it's super valuable to build trust, because now they know you're listening. And I think it's really important.
Wonderful. I think we'll call it a day there, because that was a great way to finish. Brian, great having you on. Thank you ever so much. Hi to Brian's wife. As again,
Lindsay says hello.
Yeah. Lindsay says hello. And congratulations. So tell everyone, finally, you've moved from San Fran and you're now where?
Yeah. So my wife and I did something crazy, and I'm coming to you from our new house that we purchased in just outside of Palm Springs, California. So we are now in the desert. We decided to up and move out of San Francisco. My wife and I had been there for about 10 years, and we were looking for a change of scenery, something that would get us closer to the outdoors. Yeah. And with the whole COVID pandemic going on, we're like, well, let's quarantine down in the desert. And so yeah. We are down here working on our fixer upper. You know, we're working on house projects almost every weekend. And so that's what we've been focusing on.
All right. Brilliant. Thanks ever so much, Brian. Awesome. Take care.
Cheers, Jonathan.